Welcome to Simply Scottish, a podcast of all things Scottish, with music, features, interviews, and more.
Welcome to Simply Scottish. I'm your host, Andrew McDermott. On this episode of Simply Scottish, we explore the enduring legacy of the Carnegie Library buildings in Scotland. More in a minute, but let's keep listening. Between 1883 and 1929, over 2,500 libraries were built across the English-speaking world with funds gifted from Scottish steel magnate and philanthropist Andrew Carnegie. We'll zoom in on a few as we review the fate of Scotland's Carnegie buildings. Are they still serving their communities as hubs of learning and discovery? Or have they been confined to history? By the way, if you enjoy Simply Scottish, like us on Facebook to be the first to know about new episodes and take advantage of our music giveaways. Find us at facebook.com/simplyscottish. Get more episodes of the podcast on the website simplyscottish.com or through your favourite podcast app. Simply Scottish is available on Apple's Podcasts app, TuneIn, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, and Podomatic. Let's kick things off with more music. Here's Claire Gullen and friends with a brand new West Coast Cayley jig in the traditional style, written to celebrate a special tree on the Hebridean island of Eriskay, planted over 100 years ago by poet Father Alan MacDonald. It was Woodland Trust's Tree of the Year in 2018. This is Nettie's Tree. Besides promoting my homeland of Scotland, another of my interests is technology and the digital age. I write a blog, ageofthesmartphone.com, where I encourage people to live authentically in the digital age. How to continue being human and keep thinking for yourself with all this tech around us. So I follow news stories about the big tech companies, and something Apple worked on recently caught my attention. In May 2019, Apple launched a grand reopening after spending $30 million on a complete restoration of a 1903 Carnegie Library building in Washington, D.C. I was intrigued, and it made me think of a story I've wanted to cover for a few years now, the fate of the world's Carnegie Library buildings. I thought it would be interesting to take a comprehensive look at these structures, which can be found in over a dozen countries, including Serbia, Belgium, the Caribbean, Fiji, and others. Most are over a century old now, while a few have still to hit that milestone. Were they still libraries? Were they now bingo halls, or worse yet, standing derelict, or even razed to make room for something else? Such a review of over 2,500 libraries would be a hefty project. I thought a good start might be to first look at Scotland, the homeland of Andrew Carnegie, and see how things stood there. I shared my idea with one of Scotland's national daily newspapers, The Herald, and they liked it. I've written for several Scottish interest magazines, but not for one of Scotland's national newspapers, so I was happy to write something for them. I only had a few days to pull something together, and I enjoyed the thrill of writing on deadline again. And there was a bit of detective work to be done too. To find out the status of Scotland's Carnegie libraries, I had to look up most of them by hand, using a list I had found online of all the local authorities in Scotland that were assisted by Carnegie in providing a public library to their constituents. It kept me up into the night a few times, but I was finally able to come up with a number, and I shared that in my article for the Herald. I'll share the article with you now, and after some more music, I'll share clips from my interview with American historian Kenneth Breisch about Carnegie Libraries in the United States, where Carnegie the man built his fortune in the steel industry in Pennsylvania during the second half of the 19th century. The title, Tech Giant Recharges Carnegie's Legacy for the iPhone Generation. He was worth more in his day than even the richest of the 21st century's digital billionaires. At the peak of his wealth, Scottish-born Andrew Carnegie had more money than the Tsar of Russia, and arguably nearly as much power. The metal magnate was to give away almost all of his fortune, paying for nearly 3,000 libraries the world over. Now, a key part of that legacy has been saved by the Carnegie Steel of the new millennium, Apple. The tech giant has invested more than £23 million to restore Carnegie Library in Washington, D.C. The iconic Beaux Arts Monument is just a mile away from the White House on Mount Vernon Square. Apple's conservation experts took 2 years to revitalize the building, inside and out. The computer company now has a store and an educational facility in the 1903 structure, which Apple will share with the current tenants, the Historical Society of Washington, D.C. The charity also opened a brand new D.C. History Center, complete with research library, 3 galleries, and a museum store. I love the synergy between old and new, the juxtaposition of the historic fabric and contemporary design, said Apple's chief design officer, Johnny Ive. The restoration, however, just like the strike-breaking, wage-depressing Carnegie, is not without its critics. Some question whether or not the library can remain a free space for the public while also housing a for-profit company's flagship store. University of Southern California historian Kenneth Breisch, author of America's Libraries, 1730 to 1950, said, "It'll be interesting to see how that plays out. I just question whether or not it will ever really be as democratic and public as it originally was as a public library. It'll be intimidating to a lot of people who don't have $500 or $700 to fork out for an iPhone." Meanwhile, Carnegie's legacy in Scotland is largely faring well. In total, 56 boroughs and parish councils throughout Scotland received the tycoon's assistance to establish one or more local public libraries. A review of those local authorities reveals that over 70% have Carnegie buildings that still function as libraries today, a testament not only to the man who made them possible, but also to the locals who have used them and maintained them over the last century. Some buildings have recently benefited from renovations and extensions. The Dunfermline Carnegie Library, for example, the first one that the tycoon funded, in 1883, underwent a 3-year extension project that finished in 2017. It introduced a museum over 2 floors, 3 exhibition galleries, a new children's library, a local archives study space, and a mezzanine cafe with impressive views of Dunfermline Abbey and the Heritage Quarter. The Carnegie Library in West Calder, originally opened in 1904, also experienced a refresh in 2017. The 20-week project included restoring the library's original floors and creating a modern environment with new shelving and furniture. West Lothian Council member Dave King praised the project at its completion, saying it would ensure that the building will continue to be at the heart of the town for years to come. In a digital age of Apple and Google, do these projects mean we still need libraries? Another of Carnegie's legacies, the UK Trust he set up in 1913, thinks so. It commissioned a survey that found around half the population use public libraries, and of those users, 2 in 5 use the library at least once a month. Meanwhile, people are far more likely to say the library is important to their community, around 3/4, than to themselves personally, 2/5, according to the study. The Trust is also partnering in the development of Scotland's first national strategy for public libraries, and they're encouraging innovation and public engagement through initiatives like the Carnegie Library Lab and Engaging Libraries. Carnegie funded over 2,500 libraries throughout the English-speaking world, including 660 in the UK and Ireland, and almost 1,700 in the United States. why did he do it? Carnegie spent his teenage years as a telegraph messenger boy, benefiting from access to a small library funded by a retired merchant. He believed this is what made him his fortune. As Carnegie wrote to an applicant for a library building, "I believe that it outranks any other one thing a community can do to benefit its people. It is a never-failing spring in the desert." Well, back to music now with up-and-coming Scottish band Eyvall. Inspired by a family's yachting adventures, the track is called Wind Song. From their first studio album, this is How the Ladies Dance. Thank you. This is Simply Scottish. On this episode, we're looking at the legacy of Andrew Carnegie and his library buildings, specifically in Scotland. As you heard from my report in the Herald newspaper, over 70% of Scotland's Carnegie Library buildings still function as libraries today. And although I didn't research the rest of the UK, I'd venture to say the percentage across the United Kingdom as a whole would come out to be about the same. Because these countries have so much history, and the people are used to living in historical environments where experts have much experience preserving elements of national heritage, old buildings tend to fare better and have a longer shelf life, so to speak. In younger countries like the US, where innovation and modernity are woven into the cultural fabric, it's not surprising that 100-year-old buildings would give way sometimes to larger, more technologically advanced structures. While writing my piece for the Herald, I connected with American historian Kenneth Breisch, founder and director of the University of Southern California graduate programs in historic conservation. He's also the author of the recent book America's Libraries, 1730 to 1950. I asked Breisch how he thought Carnegie's library philanthropy shaped the history and development of libraries in America. Here's what he had to say.
Well, in an incredibly dramatic way, I guess I would say, based on my research, I would say that there were probably around 500 public library buildings, you know, purpose-built structures in the United States before 1900. And, you know, although Carnegie began to fund libraries in some of his steel towns in the very late 1880s and 1890s, it wasn't until about 1899-1900 that he really began his large-scale philanthropy. And, you know, between then and really World War One, but about 1920, he funded some almost 1700 libraries in the United States. So it was an incredible expansion. And the main, I think, focus of the American public library movement before 1900 was in New England, the Mid-Atlantic states, and the Midwest for the most part, as well as California, I suppose. But what Carnegie did was really allow for the construction of libraries all across the country. And so his philanthropy really was, I think, responsible for spreading the public library movement on a large scale into the American South, and out onto the Great Plains and into the American West, where there, you know, were some public libraries, but very few buildings, nothing as grand as were constructed with his money. So that made a huge difference. And then after the early years of the 20th century, he really focused his attention on small libraries in small towns across the United States. So, you know, in the South, on the American Plains. But he also began to fund branch libraries in large cities. I think, you know, you had mentioned earlier before we started that Apple has rehabilitated the Washington, D.C. Carnegie Library. That's one of a relatively rare number of large public libraries. And he didn't build a lot of those after 1900, but he did begin to focus attention on neighborhoods in large urban areas. In the early 20th century, for instance, he gave the city of New York more than $5 million to build 67 branch libraries, you know, in Manhattan and the boroughs. And the intention there was to really place those in working class neighborhoods, places where people didn't have access to libraries, and for the most part didn't have access to the large central library, the New York Public Library. You know, that was a trek for them. And so he really, based on his, you know, sort of philosophy of self-help and uplift, he really felt that this was the place for branch libraries because of, you know, the concentration of working class and poor and immigrants too, because he was interested in the idea of Americanization through the, you know, the library.
I asked Bryce if he knew of any data on how many Carnegie libraries in America are still operational as libraries.
No, I guess I'd have to say it's a question that not only I've, you know, been curious about, but I know other, you know, scholars in the field have wondered about that. And I don't think there's any, there's been any real survey, which would be pretty time consuming in some ways, although I suppose now, certainly in the age of the internet, it would be easier to do than it would have been. I know a lot of the buildings survive, but they've been repurposed often as local cultural centers, as historical societies. So they're still sort of carrying on something of the Carnegie mission, but the public libraries for themselves, you know, themselves have really, you know, outgrown what were relatively small buildings when they were constructed in the early 20th century.
Bryce also gave his thoughts on Apple's multi-million dollar transformation of the Carnegie Library in Washington, D.C.
So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out in my mind, because the building's still there and, you know, Apple, I know, wants to use it as a kind of, community center of sorts, as they've along the lines that they've been transforming some of their Apple stores. But, you know, I just question whether or not it will ever really be as democratic and public as, you know, it originally was as a public library, I think.
I also asked Bryce if libraries were still important in the digital age.
Well, I think libraries, you know, ironically, have become almost more important than they had, you know, before the digital age. They were falling on hard times to some extent. And, you know, thanks to librarians, public librarians, they've really revitalized themselves and made themselves in many places, essential sort of cultural centers for the community, which has always been the case, but really expanded their cultural programming with, you know, free films and concerts. There are children's reading programs, which go all the way back to the 19th century, but, you know, they're still really popular with families. I know here in Santa Monica, where I live, you know, there's just a constant stream of parents with their young children going into the children's reading room, which is pretty extensive. And there's a corner set apart for the young kids. They borrow lots of books and bring them home, which is something you can't really do with, you know, with a computer to the same degree, I guess. They're serving a really important function. They're a little overwhelmed, I think, by it often, but the librarians are an amazing lot. They're really dedicated to complete openness and creating this sort of democratic, welcoming atmosphere.
When I asked Bryce to make an educated guess as to the percentage of Carnegie libraries still functioning as libraries in America today, he put it at around half, or 50%, which many would say is still quite the legacy in today's modern age. As for the buildings in other countries, I haven't looked into that yet, and I still think it would be interesting to find out. I know, for example, that the one and only Carnegie Library on the island country of Fiji in the South Pacific Ocean is still open today and looks, from pictures, like it's still going strong. In Belgium, a Carnegie Library was built in the 1920s for the University of Leuven to replace a building destroyed in the First World War. Funding for that came from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, which also built libraries in war-damaged cities in France and Serbia. The Leuven Library still stands today. I'd venture to say that you probably live not too far away from a Carnegie Library building yourself. Drop me an email and tell me about it. It's andrew@simplyscottish.com. That's andrew@simplyscottish.com. I'll look forward to hearing from you about the Carnegie Library near you, if you have one, and just to say hello. It's always great to hear from listeners. We'll conclude this time with music from Ullapool-based musician Kim Richards. It's called The Mermaid, inspired by the folktale The Mermaid Wife. I'm Andrew McDermott. Tune in again soon for another celebration of all things Scottish.
In a house by the sea together, there is a family.
Simply Scottish is hosted and produced by Andrew McDermid. Show content, copyright, Simply Scottish Media. All music is used with consent of copyright holders. Continue your Simply Scottish experience at simplyscottish.com. Thanks for listening.
Fills him, knowing he's not all she needs, and he's so different from his wondrous wayward wife, but loving her is all he sees. He stands on the shore and he calls out her name. He was searching for the thing that went away. He was yearning for a love that did not stay. She left without warning, just to have a cold bed in the morning. He was searching for the thing that went away. All along the beach she wanders, night draws in, the half light fades. Her heart is with another out of sight, a life lived long ago. Of absent fun.